Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Amwha Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Wildberg, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Amwha Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, as almost always, Adam Wilder. And today, I'm joined by Jim Petrosky, the president of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. And Jim, I had asked you to come on NucleCast because you are, you know, one of the nation's top, you know, hardened electronics and radiation experts. And, you know, you're an engineering, you're an engineer, but you know, engineering physics is your specialty, and you work in hardened electronics, and you've got a background in, you know, nuclear physics, and one of the big things that is, you know, becoming increasingly important as we think about the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, and we've seen some articles and studies come out recently about the potential use of EMP detonation over the United States, and what would that do to our electronics, and what would that do to our electrical system, and of course to American life. And who better than one of the nation's leading experts on that very topic to have on to talk about this idea of building resilient energy infrastructure. And, you know, what does that look like? Can we do it? Are EMPs, you know, sort of the problem that we think they will, where they're going to, you know, send us back into the Stone Age? And I thought, you know, this is a big topic. It's an important one. It's one we haven't talked about a ton. And I thought, you know, let's bring one of the guys who, you know, has been spending, you know, 20, 30 years on that topic to talk about it. So let's talk about resilient energy and infrastructure. What are we talking about here? What does this sort of this concept mean, and why does it matter to, you know, an audience of NucleCast, which, you know, everybody's mostly in the nuclear enterprise, and so why do we care about this?
Yeah, well, thank you, Adam, for the introduction. The first piece is why, you know, we talk about nuclear, and I'm going back to sort of resilient energy. Like, what's the connection? But you start to see the connection even in what's going on with the concept of tariffs. You know, people don't realize that the United States has a couple power grids, and those couple power grids, first of all, are lucrative targets to our adversaries. You have three power grids. Take out any one. In fact, in the past, we've had one go down and the other two go down because they're so interconnected. They're designed around basically a 1950s, 1960s electrical grid that worked for the time, worked for the industries we had available. And so decoupling energy in the country from deterrence against adversaries that seek to overtake your country is impossible. Energy is a major part of this. And so so I thought maybe I'd start somewhere where your audience may not know, and that is in Europe. And you think, well, why are you starting with Europe? Well, Europe recently, and past actually decade, has rebuilt its energy grid to be more resilient. Now, they did it for other reasons, and there's spinoff reasons why this would happen. But bear with me, Adam. What they've done is they've built a resilient energy system because they have different countries with different requirements interacting with trading energy and sharing energy among the European countries. And so they had to build something that was robust and capable of being shared. Now, the way they've done that is sort of interesting. They effectively rebuilt their energy system so it could take on power, drop off power. They could share, they could transfer. If someone went down, they had another mean to do that. And it made them more resilient. In fact, the European energy grid is the strongest, is the most robust, the most modernized energy grid in the world. And they can take on wind power, solar power, add and subtract. And if if there were ever a nuclear war in Russia or over Russia or over Europe that would launch an EMP, they can segment out countries from power grid so they can continue to function. So you don't lose everything, you lose some things. And so, you know, I've talked in other podcasts about the whack-a-mole theory, but the whack-a-mole theory is give so many targets that you're never going to get them all. And so therefore you deter your adversary. And the Europeans have done this well. In fact, their energy grid plan, sorry, I just get excited about this stuff because energy management sounds boring, but it's not. But what they've done is they've built a long-term grid that allows renewables to be added and subtracted. They've developed a faster permitting process so they can get things on board quicker. And they've actually divided their grid into many different supply chains so they're not singularly dependent. So when you talk about energy from a resilience standpoint, in Europe, they've sort of set the tone. So that's my opening salvo. Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it's certainly, you know, my dad was a power systems engineer for his whole career. So, you know, and as he's designed grids and worked on them, you know, it's been something that I've sort of paid attention to, but it was never my focus area. But, you know, Texas having its own grid and then the Western Electric grid, that's, you know, he was set on the board that ran the Western Electric grid. And then, you know, what we've seen in the East, and we've seen brownouts in California, we've seen them in, you know, in the Northeast. And then we saw, you know, what snow could do to the Texas grid whenever, you know, solar panels were covered in snow and ice. And when the wind turbines were, you know, frozen over and couldn't produce solar, and you had these massive, you know, power outages. But as we think about, how do we prevent this? How do we make it more resilient, particularly, like we said, to, you know, EMP detonations? What is the solution to it? How do we actually do this?
So interestingly, again, this is why it fits very well with NucleaCast, is not just an EMP solution, but in many of the aspects of the power, the grid resiliency, affect us in modernizing and, as I said, adding and subtracting power, removing what I call large juicy targets. You know, if you put everything in one basket, then you only have one target to go after. And certainly in a nuclear war, that becomes your target. And so there are many things that are going to build resiliency against the things you talked about. Texas, ice into Texas power grid. My favorite experience was moving to California in 1994 or 5, I think it was, and they had a severe coronal mass ejection, which, by the way, if our audience hasn't ever read about it, read about the Carrington event that happened in the 1800s, that people weren't so reliant on electricity yet. Telegraph lines, et cetera, caught fire. Telegraphs that were unplugged started running again. They got so much current driven into them. These are things that happen naturally. It's not just a nuclear war. The natural things that you've talked about. In 1990, again, 4 or 5, they had a coronal mass ejection. It kicked the power off that was being supplied by Canada to New York, and that killed the Eastern Interconnect. The Eastern Interconnect went down. The Western Interconnect could not respond, so it went down. And, of course, I was in the Western Interconnect in California. We lost power for several hours. So that vulnerability exists. And when you lose electrical power, the military can sustain for a while, but you are vulnerable as a country for many of the emergency, et cetera, systems we have. So you ask about a solution. You know, I'm a nuclear engineer, or play one on TV. Now, I'm a nuclear engineer, and I look at the nuclear power industry, and it's largely untapped in the U.S. And when we first built our first nuclear power stations, one of the things with them is they're extremely expensive to build because you put all the investment in the infrastructure up front. Actually, the fuel is so cheap at one time, they figured you just build them. Once you paid for that, the fuel is almost free. Too cheap to meter. They wouldn't even come out and meter your house because it's more expensive to come out and read the meter than just give it to you for free. Okay, with nuclear power, that was a concept in the 60s. But we built these large plants. But large plants, of course, are these large plants are again, big, juicy targets, and they run for long periods of time. So, that's good from a sustainability standpoint, but we're looking now at saying, well, what if we built what are called small modular reactors? You build them modularly, one, so they're easy to replace, and they're small, so they work for a small city, and they're maybe for a regional area. And then you don't need these large transfer stations, and you may, you know, since you worked with your father on power management, we have giant, giant power transmission stations that if one of them were to fail in an EMP or coronal mass ejection or a weather event or whatever it may be, or a terrorist, one of those goes down. It takes years to build them. So if you don't have a replacement on hand, you got to build one, and you have to wait 3 years, and then installing it takes a long time. But if you want smaller reactors that can be a small footprint, could be a small area in a region, and generate power, you can break the power grid up like the Europeans have and have smaller, more resilient energy demands being met. So that's my first step. And I really like the concept of distributing our power, because we're not in the 1950s anymore, and we are also dynamic. You think about, you know, AI now, they're building massive computer centers that will use more power than some small towns, and they need their own power source. Where are they going to get that? We're going to do it with coal. We're going to build oil. And, you know, it's taking a large footprint. Solar, I mean, you take up half a county just to power a small, you know, a building full of computers.
Small modular reactors.
Yep.
We're most of the nuclear generation we have in this country, you know, it's first gen.
Sure.
It's, you know, it's been around since, you know, the 60s and 70s. These reactors have been around at least 50 years. They're, you know, generally as old as our nuclear weapons.
Right.
And so we're now in like third and fourth gen reactor designs. And, you know, for anybody who's interested, go up to Idaho National Labs and, you know, take the public tour and talk to their folks, and they can walk you through sort of where we are and where we started. And you can still go tour. A few years ago, I was on vacation and toured the original nuclear reactor. It was great. What a great experience. So talk me through where have we come from and where are we now? When you say, you know, like nuclear generators in neighborhoods and things like that, you know, people think of Fukushima, or, you know, they think of the nuclear power plants in the Ukraine. And, you know, there's, you know, we've seen the TV shows on, I'm forgetting what
Chernobyl.
Yeah, but what there's a mini series on Chernobyl that's on Peacock or Paramount or one of those. Yeah. But you know, so walk us through, what does that technology look like today?
So a lot of the U.S. nuclear reactors were built on pressurized water or boiling water reactors, and the inherent they were inherently safe in that if you lost water in these large nuclear reactors, the reaction shuts down. So unlike a gas fire, you start lighting it, it's going to burn till the fuel burns. Whereas in a water reactor, when it loses the water, it shuts itself down. Now, the problem with that generation, and that's the generation one and two kinds of reactors, the problem with that is what you saw at Three Mile Island. You still have water under pressure, and you have what's called latent heat. If you turn something off, you take the water away, it still continues to heat up until it's done, you know, liberating all of its energy, and it begins to cool down convectively. So the early reactors, that was the safety issue. You have water under pressure, and you heat it up, it becomes more pressure, and eventually that water, that pressure has to go somewhere. And in the case of Three Mile Island, they had to do what's, you know, it burped, if you will, it released some steam, and that's how they got rid of that pressure until it cooled down. Other reactors, like you heard about in Chernobyl, they were actually designed with flaws in them, that the RBMK reactor, if you brought it down to a certain power level and then brought it back up, it went out of control. And that's exactly what happened. In fact, few people know that the Chernobyl reactors, the engineers and scientists, who I love, said, do not do this. And then, of course, they did it. And they found out exactly what happened in Chernobyl. They had a reactor on fire. And in the Fukushima incident, again, the biggest problem with Fukushima is they lost power and they couldn't cool the reactors. And therefore, you got high pressure. And once again, late heat, high pressure, lack of pumping, because you have lack of energy. You have a problem with that. The Gen 4, the newer generation reactors, which we have not built, and there are some built. Actually, the Russians built one on a barge, I believe, was commissioned just like 8 or 9 years ago. These Gen 4 and Gen 5 reactors are small. So you think you're controlling a lot less energy. You have a lot less, fewer reactive components. You have a lower radioactive inventory in the reactor. And the high temperature gas reactors, they don't have the pressure. So you've gotten rid of most of the safety problems, and they're inherently safe. So if you lose control of them, they just shut down convectively. They literally just keep giving off their heat. And in fact, these smaller reactors, the heat generation can be sort of used for generation of things like hydrogen. You could separate water, oxygen, and hydrogen in them and build a hydrogen transportation economy. Imagine the United States being that way. We generate electricity with our small generators in a city, and then we separate hydrogen and oxygen. You take the hydrogen, put it in your car, and drive around. And that's almost free because it's waste heat off of the reactor. I mean, these things can happen if we're willing to step forward. The other piece about the small reactors is they take less time to build. So a normal reactor right now, especially with all safety and everything else, takes 8 or 9 years to get on the ground, just to get it, you know, off the footprint. The modular reactors are being designed by the engineers to be built quickly, to be put on the ground, to be used. I mean, you used to work for an organization that had these little small modular reactors that are pushing submarines around. In the ocean, right? And yeah. So that's just a small modular reactor, and very, very inherently safe. We've never had nuclear explosions with our submarines, etc. And in fact, some of them are so proliferation designed that they literally design them so you don't refuel them. You run them for 20, 25 years, and then they're done. And then they're still contained and self-contained, and you put them somewhere, and they, over time, the radioactivity dies off and you have, you're done with them. Very much throwaway. Can you imagine powering a city for 30 years with something and having the throwaway, a self-contained module smaller than your room? Think of what a city gets rid of in just coal waste in terms of size, literally 60, 70 train containers filled with coal almost every day fueling it versus 20 years and a small module you get rid of. So they're very good that way. But so that's for the reactor community. But I want to go back and say, if you modularize and get smaller, you get a smaller footprint, you distribute the energy, you design the electrical power grid to do that. So if you do have an EMP or whatever, or a coronal mass ejection or some terrorist or anything else, you still have distributed power. So you're going to take out, let's just use 50 states. If every state had their own modular reactor and its own power grid, and they were interconnected, and you took out a big state, I don't know, Alaska, you took out Alaska or Texas or something, Kansas, where you are in the middle of the country, the rest of the country still continues to function. That becomes a deterrent to the adversaries trying to take out a component of this. Now, the resilient power grid also then can be designed to be, resilient against the effects of EMP by overcharging, because the reactor itself is not connected to the power systems themselves. It's connected to the generators. So again, smaller generators, easier to replace, keep a couple on hand, transfer stations, keep a couple small ones on hand, build them in the US instead of overseas because they take specialized materials, and voila, we have a replacement system in hand, on deck, ready to go. Why even mess with the US? Go somewhere else where it's a lot easier to play with. That's sort of my proposition I make.
So what then is the, we sort of have come to realize, at least, some have, that, wind and solar is not the panacea that folks may have thought initially. It can't produce in adverse weather, right? This is what the state of Texas learned, and you can't predict the weather. You know, it takes up lots of space, right? If you go to Cape Cod, right, this is a, you know, this is a big NIMBY issue for Cape Cod. They don't want, you know, wind farms off of their coast because they don't want to look at them. And, you know, solar, big solar fields are, you know, they have their downsides for, you know, native life and stuff because you put them out in the middle of nowhere. But if you're going to build small modular reactors, it sort of seems like a reasonable thing to do. You know, they're clean, they're safe, they're, you know, they're, this is
reliable.
Gen 4 versus Gen 1. So you've sort of addressed the safety issues from, you know, it's like saying, well, I don't want nuclear because, you know, an Edsel isn't as safe as, you know, a modern, you know, Expedition with, you know, side airbags and mm-hmm. cameras and all that. You know, it's just not the same. They're just not the same thing. And so what then is the big problem with producing, you know, nuclear power here in the U.S.? The French do it. They're relying on nuclear. Why have we not done more to build nuclear power?
Well, that's the, you know, the sort of the 800-pound gorilla in the room, right? Because industry's ready to roll. You know, like many, many things, industry could probably get started on putting reactors on the ground, you know, in a year or two. Seriously, they're ready to go. They need to produce the fuel. They need to, they've got the modular designs. So it's not an industrial issue. It's more a political issue. And again, the small modular reactors do leave themselves to that because it's going to take you 8 years and you're going to invest all the money to build a reactor up front. Let's think, 8 years. What happens on about an 8 year cycle? Well, we change leadership about every 4 years. And of course, in Congress, what about every 3 years? So even if you were able to get the political will to do it, that political will is going to go away in a couple of years. And so now you've got to, you're going to change hands. And who's going to invest in something that's going to take that long? And you put all the money up front, billions of dollars, only to find out, like what happened in New York back in the 70s, where they put the plant on the ground and then it was shuttered just because there wasn't political will to open it. And so investors lose their money. So that's a problem. And so that's one big hurdle. The other hurdle, and again, it has a very close parallel to nuclear weapons, is that we have a society who has not been given an opportunity to understand what it is that nuclear energy does, how it functions. We work on emotion instead of logic or understanding. Now, you know, it will change as we move forward. It has to, because we have not much of a choice. We're getting to where France was, where, you know, they said no coal, no oil, no choice, and they moved forward and they had a political will to do it. They also prepared their citizenry by teaching them what is it, not, you know, there's conflict, don't get me wrong, but if you understand something, you can have a logical argument about something versus having someone say, well, I don't like nuclear because, and this is a quote I had from someone, there was a friend of mine saying, well, they're blowing up all over the place. So what do you mean nuclear reactors are blowing up all over the place? Their view was that we're always in this state of nuclear damage from something. I mean, just completely off the rails. We've got to educate. And that's part of what, you know, we do at NIDS. I know ANWAL does something similar. We do that same problem for nuclear weapons. What are they used for? Why do we have them, et cetera? Nuclear reactors, the same thing. But I think the country's begun to realize that. And especially, you know, going back to solar and wind, I think people are starting to see that solar and wind have a place, but they're not the panacea. They're not going to give it to us. And I want to clear something here while we're talking, while mentioning solar and wind, where small modular reactors play an interesting role. So in the past, for nuclear energy, we used them for baseline power. So you look at the energy you're going to use for an area, and you say, what's the 90% level that I need always? And you built nuclear reactors for those because reactors are best designed and best used. You bring them up to power and you leave them alone until you have to refuel them about 3 years later. By the way, 3 years later. So build a power plant, and sometimes even longer with new fuel management. So imagine you're not moving fuel around. So all the dangers of moving fuel, all the dangers of transportation, all the stuff, taking it apart and putting it back together that you have with gas and coal plants, that you're feeding them fuel every day. You're not reliant on that fuel for 3 years. So your adversaries can't like play with the economy like, okay, you know, mess with my fuel this year. I'll get it fixed up next year, you know, in terms of costs. Okay. Now, small modular reactors, if we have many of them, they will be, because they're smaller, they are more dynamic. So they can take up the increase in reduction and reduction in fuel or energy needs. So if solar is attached to your power grid and it's generating well today on a day like here in Ohio where it's sunny, then they can bring the power down and let the solar take over. And if you have a dynamic power grid, tomorrow's cloudy and cold and everyone turns their heat on, they just crank the nuclear back up. You don't have to play the baseline power game. So the modern nuclear power distribution system is extremely efficient and extremely mobile and fits into, doesn't go against all these renewable energies that, you know, there's good use for them in places where they make sense. And there's not good use for them when they're forced on us in other places. So that's where I see the future. But again, it's public and politics. That's what needs to change. And we do that by informing people like we're doing in this podcast. And we need a community of people that are willing to go out there and talk to the naysayers and talk to them intelligently about what's happening.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Amlaw Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
Now it's that time in NucleCast where we like to bring out Bob the Genie. So as I rub my magic lamp, Bob grants you 3 wishes related to the topics we've discussed today. So with that said, Jim, what is your first wish?
Well, it's pretty much easy to figure out since I just sort of answered your question in the end here. My first interest is, of course, it is always about the public because, you know, we live in a democratic republic. So people matter. But they have to know what's happening. And I think we've lost that in many industrial areas. We let someone else think about it. But I think everyone needs to be in the know and understand what's happening because they find the value in it. So my first wish is that we have some national level, state level, local level way of introducing nuclear energy to our citizenry so they understand it and can make smart, informed decisions. That's number one. Okay.
Then that'll take some TikTok videos, maybe some YouTube shorts.
Yeah.
And we'll have all of the kiddos, you know, because the French did this. The French took, you know, elementary age kids to nuclear power plants and walked them through it and taught them what it was all about. And then for the kids, they're like, oh yeah, this is normal stuff. This is how we have air conditioning and how we have electricity and how we watch TV and, you know, so therefore they had a naturally positive view of nuclear energy. So TikTok videos will do that.
And for those listeners to this show that are in government, remember those kiddos that you're talking about in second, third, and fourth grade, you know, many years later were voters. So, understood the issue. I mean, they became comfortable with it. And you're exactly right, Adam. So my second wish then would go to the other side, that we would find the political will based upon our national strategy for deterrence, but also our national strategy for our country to be able to build a strong economy and build it around energy, because energy is the future. I mean, we've all seen Mad Max. We know that's the answer of the future. It's all going to be about energy. And so energy is the future and nuclear is the future for us. And so I would hope that our politicians become as schooled as we hope our citizenry would be and have the political wherewithal to say this is important and help the citizens understand that. So that's number two for me. Okay. And then number three. Number three. Okay. My number three is pretty good. I would hope by the time I reach 70, which is 8 years from now, that I would see those modular reactors moving into place. I think that's a very doable thing for the United States, because then I know my grandchildren have a strong energy and a strong national security future, because that future is not going to go well if we keep depending on Canada for energy. Really? We're going to be depending on what? Shipping fuel from Russia like the Europeans do for energy? It's not going to work in their future. I want it to be better than mine. And so I think this concept of small modular reactors and distributed resilient power grid is really, really important. It's probably one of our top security issues, whether it's EMP, whether it's another Carrington event, whether it's a sabotage, it doesn't matter. This solves all of those problems and builds our economy the way we want to have it. And I hope my grandkids could see that.
Yeah, I'm mostly interested in, I want to build an off-grid house, maybe an Earth ship. I'm looking for the right land for that. But wouldn't it be great if by the time I finally built my off-grid home, we had, what was that movie, The Martian, where he had his own, little nuclear reactor that he used to power his little Martian outpost. So I could really use a little nuclear reactor to power my off-grid house. That would just be, that'd be about perfect for me. So I'm looking forward to that day. That's going to be the day I really find things to be awesome. So
for the audience that gets the video, I'm sticking in front of my camera now. I know it's a little goofy here. This is a National Geographic magazine, the top article, You and the Obedient Atom. There's an entire article here, not Adam Lowther, he's not obedient at all, but You and the Obedient Atom. And there's an article here about nuclear power modules for homes that was envisioned, and the technology was there. What was the year? This was 1958. In 1958, we had the technology to build small thermal reactors inside your house that would basically be radiothermal generators, and they would give you enough energy in your house from an RTG to power your house, and you would have to replace the fuel approximately every 40 years.
That would be great. That's what I need.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Jim, thanks for joining us on NucleCast. Great discussion. Hopefully the listeners found it interesting. It's a topic we don't talk about a lot. So hopefully now they're thinking about, I care about the Russians, the Chinese. I'm a little worried about EMPs, but now I'm thinking about resilient energy infrastructure and how do we make that happen? And how do we keep trucking better yet than just keep trucking if we face an EMP attack, let's deter it from the beginning because they know it won't achieve the objectives. That would be even better.
That's deterrence.
All right. Well, thanks, Jim. And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast. And we'll see you next time. It's an interesting discussion. We've had two or three episodes on NucleCast where we talked about nuclear energy as opposed to weapons. We've talked about the production of, uranium enrichment. We've had some interesting discussions. And this just sort of adds to that discussion that we've had periodically, and it's one, the idea of how do we keep our country as a modern first world country after an EMP attack is one that a lot of us worry about. And so having Jim come and say, hey, we can prevent that in the first place by taking these steps, that was a great discussion. Hopefully you enjoyed it as well.
This has been a production of the Anwa Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.